Over the last 90 minutes, we've talked about all of the ills that we have in the country. Some people would claim that all the ills would be solved if we just let the government do everything. Under a term which I guess has widely been defined as democratic socialism. So Tom went out and found us someone who can talk about exactly what it is we might be wishing for and whether we should be careful what we're wishing for in that regard. So Joel Kotkin is an internationally recognized authority on global economic, political, and social trends. I am an authority on nine of those. So that is why we have the expert on the phone with us today. Good morning, Joel. Thanks for being here.
It's nice to be here.
So let's start with this term. Democratic socialism, it's gaining a lot of traction, I think particularly amongst young people, and
yes.
And I have my suspicions as to why, and I think it relates as to where we are in time as much as anything else, but that's just my theory. You can hopefully help us, A, define this, and B, weigh in on why it seems to be gaining popularity in the country.
Well, I think, you know, there are many different definitions. There is a strong tradition in Europe and even in the United States of what we might call social democrats, which are basically democratic socialists, is essentially the same thing. And that comes out of a tradition that's very respectful of the Constitution, very respectful of, you know, in many cases actually was very anti-communist. And there was sort of that tradition, although there are many of the democratic socialists today, for instance, like Bernie Sanders, are far less in that sort of social democratic tradition than many of the, the European social democrats. In other words, that there's kind of a twist in the current democratic socialists, which is much more authoritarian and much more identified on what we might call identity issues. You know, gay, feminist, environmental. As opposed to traditional working class issues, because the base of democratic socialism, and not just in this country, but in Australia and in Europe, is now essentially the young and parts of the upper middle class, particularly the professionals, who, you know, don't own businesses, are in many ways insulated from the private economy.
Would it be safe to say, Joel, that, you know, our country is relatively young as it relates to other, you know, areas of the world, that when these things first started to pop up, Social Security, for instance, that in that regard of it being sort of a social program, but it was, unless I misunderstand how it was created with an idea of looking out for those who couldn't really look out for themselves, which would be sort of an overall tenet inside the Constitution of the U.S. to say, wait, you know,
right,
we are here to protect those people from, you know, tyranny and all those things too, but also to look out for those that may not have the means or the ability to look out for themselves, and that's what the Constitution was supposed to do. So when you said, well, wait a minute, we have a bunch of older people here, and you know, once they stop working, either because they no longer physically can or whatever, they are destitute. We need to rescue them from that. The creation of Social Security in that time was a positive.
Right, and I think many people on the left would point out that many Republicans called Social Security socialism. So, you know, sometimes people overuse the term socialism mm-hmm. for any kind of social program. And I think that defeats the case fundamentally against socialism, because you have to say, hey, look, there are certain degrees of government intervention that are necessary for a civilized society. I think, you know, you can debate how wide that is. The danger is that the current democratic socialism is veering into a very different direction. And you can see that, for instance, with the Green New Deal, which, you know, essentially would put the country at the mercy of sort of a group of, you know, self-appointed experts who will tell us how to do everything. And there's also a very bad tendency that I see today, which is whereas the idea of social democracy was that we would help the working class get into the middle class, and then they would be more independent. Instead, what we have is this idea that everybody should get a $2,000 check from the government, and you know, people can spend their entire lives, you know, as renters and as, essentially as serfs. And that's the unfortunate direction. So, in other words, democratic socialism can't be defined as one thing at one time. It seems to be evolving, and in many cases, in ways that are not particularly good.
If I were to take a guess, I suggest that today's democratic socialism and the ideas of, this guaranteed minimum income, of health care for all, of free education, of all the things that are talked about, is because we have created in the society a sort of a sense of hopelessness. I am never going to be able to afford a heart transplant. I'm never going to be able to afford a college. And for most people, that is not just, you know, whining. That's true.
You're totally right. I mean, one of the things I always tell my business friends is if capitalism is not seen as a way of moving up, people are going to opt for socialism, and why shouldn't they? If you live someplace where, like where I live in Southern California, for instance, where a young couple making $150,000 a year has no hope of buying a house, okay, none, zero, that is a very, very unfair situation, and that the only people who end up buying houses, and this is very much true here and in New York and some other places, are people whose parents can do the down payment. So if you don't have inherited wealth, and you don't have a huge income, and your chances of owning a home, raising a family, moving into a nice neighborhood is minimal, then you start to say, well, you know what, maybe I should work 20 hours a week and collect a check and play video games all day.
And I'd be no better worse off, but I wouldn't be working,
right.
I wouldn't be killing myself for it.
Right, exactly. And so when you take away the prospect of upward mobility, you invite the rise of socialism. And I think this generation, as you point out, is very much in that kind of dilemma.
And I do think that, again, this is an interesting observance. You, as I understand it, Joel, have done a lot of work. I would, in my old high school days, would have called you a sociology guy. You're looking at all these things that are impacting our social structure across the country and even the world, and trends and how they're developing and where they're going. But it does seem to me that as over the years, what is termed this wealth gap has continued to widen, almost right along with it has widened the idea and the acceptance of this idea of democratic socialism.
You couldn't say it more accurately. That's precisely what's happened. And on top of that, we have the rise in the education system, and it used to be only at the college level. Now I think it's begun to penetrate into even elementary schools. You know, sort of a kind of indoctrination, which, you know, although I agree totally that we should discuss the Depression and the labor conflicts of the turn of the century, obviously the legacy of slavery, these are all legitimate things to get into, that the kind of history that our young people are increasingly taught is only about the negatives, nothing about the fact that millions and millions of people came to this country from all over the world and did infinitely better than they would have if they had stayed home. And so, you know, if you don't have any appreciation for the accomplishments of a society, then you're likely to say, well, you know what, all the American values of individualism and family and all that are failed values anyway. So we might as well go and look for some other value system. And so, you know, that is what I find really troubling is how little, for instance, our young people know about the Constitution, about why, you know, that's why you start to get people say, let's get rid of the Electoral College. Let's get rid of, let's pack the Supreme Court. All the restraints that were built into the Constitution in order to prevent both oligopolies gaining control over the country and also allowing for the minority to have their rights protected. Those ideas are gone. So you know, a lot of ways, democratic socialism is filling a enormous void that's been created by the lack of education or the miseducation of young people.
Is greed a factor here? And I say that from a standpoint of, again, if this wealth gap is something that is creating the idea that I'm never going to be able to get there, and so people are looking toward the alternatives, the wealth gap would be pretty easily solved if everybody that, you know, made $1 billion last year said, well, you know, I'll throw 20 million of it back into the coffers or whatever. And since obviously people are not going to, you know, Warren Buffett talks about it all the time, but he doesn't seem to want to be writing a check. So therefore, the only way to fix it, it seems, would be to look at the tax structure. And we have not, as at least elected officials, I think there may be a disconnect between some elected officials and the populace in general, been terribly willing to look at a more progressive and hierarchical sort of tax system as people gain more and more wealth in corporations.
Well, the problem, of course, that we have in this country, and this is one of the reasons why you do get the sort of calls from not just Bernie Sanders, but from Elizabeth Warren and many of the other leading contenders, is that these large companies and rich people don't pay taxes. That's the, you know, if you look at, at companies like Apple, and Google, and Facebook, they've all paid minimal taxes. And so, you know, the problem is that you know, saying, well, we're going to tax wealth, you know, and I know, and I can tell you as a resident of the state of California, that when it comes to looking for money, they don't get it from the super rich. They get it from the upper middle class who make enough money that it's worth taking money from them, but don't make enough money to hire the lawyers and accountants so that they don't have to pay taxes.
Good point. And I think that may be something that ultimately has the possibility to drive us right towards this democratic socialism that people are now talking about.
Exactly.
If we as a nation of people don't recognize and do something to stop this, is this kind of the inevitability that we're going to be in? And I know you've done some work, and you've got a book out there called The Next 100 Million American in 2050, which kind of looks to predict what America might look like in 2050. What were some of your conclusions there?
Well, I think I think one of the conclusions is, and it's more in some of my later books, and the one that's coming out in January. But I think that the critical thing is that if younger people do not feel that they have a shot at some sort of self-sufficiency in the system, they're going to go towards a pattern of dependency, and I think that's pretty much inevitable. And the only way you really stop it is to provide a stronger economy and more opportunity, and that opportunity has to be spread throughout the whole country. I mean, one of the great problems we have also is the concentration not just in a few hands, but the concentration of wealth and power in a very few cities, and usually in a few neighborhoods of those cities. And, you know, that makes it much, much more difficult for people to move up. I mean, I have to say, I'm not a great Donald Trump fan, but the economy that has evolved in the last year and a half is certainly better for the middle of the country, for the South, for Texas, than it has been necessarily for the coastal areas, who did very well under President Obama. The problem with the coastal areas is they're too expensive. So basically, middle-skilled, middle-class people really have no way of living in the Bay Area or most of Southern California. But they can live very well in Wisconsin, and they can live very well in Dallas. And so some of this problem could be solved by sort of geography, and some of this is happening. The good news is that younger people are moving not only to suburbs, but they're moving to smaller cities. This has just begun to come up in the numbers that we're looking at now, that in the last, let's say, 2-3 years, a lot of younger people, you know, they're getting into their 30s, and they're saying, look, if I stay in the Bay Area or I'm staying in L.A., I really can't get married. I certainly can't have kids. I'll never buy a house. And some of them are saying, you know what, maybe I'm better off if I move to Indianapolis, where my salary will buy a house in a nice neighborhood with decent schools. And that's something I simply cannot achieve in New York City or L.A. or San Francisco.
Well, that's interesting because, again, you know, your mention of the Electoral College and a lot of these things that we're talking about here do seem to be because we have segregated ourselves into these various pockets. The red Midwest, the blue coasts, and the economies that are within our overall national economy. And I think that's one of the things that escapes a lot of people when we talk about why democratic socialism is appealing, and I don't care party-wise, I just think individual-wise, why is this resonating with people? Well, because if you happen to live in a place, as you've just outlined, where it feels impossible to get there one way, you're going to choose another path. And,
exactly.
And so what has been the magnetism over the years for people to move to these big cities? Have they also had sort of an economic shift that earlier on, boy, everybody concentrated there, was all doing well, and now we've concentrated again wealth and power at the hands of too few, even in the big cities?
Oh, that's definitely the case. I mean, so that, for instance, the Bay Area, where I went to school, and I've had family there since the 1940s. If you take a place like the Bay Area, it was still a place where a middle working class person, a lot of my friends happened to have come from Michigan when I was living there. And, it was more expensive than Michigan, but not by a lot. And the opportunities were greater. Now what we have is that the cost of living, the taxes are now so high that even somebody who's making $150,000, $200,000 a year can't really afford to buy a house. And so this is creating a movement out of many of these urban core areas. So in a sense, because some of them succeeded so well in the last 20 years, they now have become impossible for middle-class families. And that's clearly happening. And so that's the other thing that you get is that the people who live in the urban core tend to have no children. They tend to be very different than the people who live in suburbia who do tend to have children.
Yeah, and again, a very different lifestyle. But you if you start to think about these dynamics, if I really can't afford to have children, I'm not going to do it in many cases, and therefore a different psyche develops in the more urban areas as opposed to the more rural areas of the country.
Right, exactly. Because, you have to understand, if you're in a place like San Francisco in a one-bedroom apartment, it's $4,500 a month. I mean, it just changes the reality completely of how you would live. I mean, people are paying, almost twice what I pay for my mortgage for a nice-sized house in Orange County, and they're paying that for a one-bedroom apartment in an okay neighborhood in San Francisco. I mean, there's a completely different trajectory. And, of course, if you're paying rent, you can't save any money, so you'll never be able to buy a house. And then you add things like student debt, and it really becomes impossible.
Mm-hmm. Joel, unpack a little bit for us the comparisons that people make, and if they're fair, to we're headed on the path to be Venezuela if we do these things that are being talked about under democratic socialism, or we're on the path to be like the Soviet Union was. Is that our future if we were to install Medicare for all, for instance, if they could figure out how to do that?
Well, I think that if you got, let's say, if you got the Green New Deal, I mean, which I think is the most extreme thing to come out politically, if you got that, basically you would be looking at, first of all, there would be no reason for the middle of the country to exist. I mean, because...
Right.
Their energy would become extremely expensive. I mean, if energy in Wisconsin costs twice as much as energy elsewhere, why would anyone set up a plant in Wisconsin? I mean, that's what's happening to us in California. We have extraordinarily high prices, and that for energy, and that drives all sorts of industry out. So, you know, so fundamentally, you have to be looking at what these programs would do. Medicare for all, some of the wealth taxes. I think, you know, it could slow growth down. It could discourage some investment. I mean, those certainly. I think you're looking probably more at sort of euro stagnation than you are the Soviet Union. You know, you're looking at, you know, growth rates of, you know, like we had largely under President Obama, you know, 1%, 1.5% instead of, let's say, 2.5% that maybe we're getting now. So fundamentally, you probably would have less growth. But in a funny way, that just makes the argument for socialism stronger. I mean, so I think what we're going to look at is we're going to look at something that probably is more like what Germany is today. You know, fairly low growth economy, aging population, people won't have children, and you know, very regulated, very security conscious. I don't think we're moving to the Soviet Union. I think that that's I mean you'd have to be completely deluded to even think that that's even any kind of decent option. And certainly not Venezuela. Venezuela is a, you know, is a particular basket case. But the fact is that many of the people who are supporting these programs have been defenders of the of Venezuela, and historically have a sympathy for authoritarian regimes. Again, that's where this division in what democratic socialism is. I mean, if you take the old Mike Harrington, Norman Thomas kind of school of democratic socialism, it was very anti-authoritarian. But there is, in the new democratic socialism, a greater degree of authoritarianism than we had in the past. And I think a lot of that comes, frankly, from the universities. The universities are the incubators of authoritarianism in this society, and it spreads into the media, it spreads into the corporate life, because you have, you know, basically indoctrination going on.
Well, part of what you said just moments ago, Joel, triggered to me, I thought, well, maybe that wouldn't be so bad then. So if we put Medicare for All in place, just using that as one example.
Right.
And that removed this cloud over all of the middle and lower middle class and lower class income earners, that they were basically one bad health experience away from bankruptcy.
Right.
And it seemed to create a better path forward now for me to actually put my nose to the grindstone and go back to the pursuit of the American dream as we once knew it, perhaps.
Right.
You could argue that that may not be the world's worst idea.
Well, it's certainly, let me put it this way, I'm not necessarily sure that we should dismantle the private healthcare system, but the fact that we should have some public alternative, and I have to say, you know, I'm, you know, fortunately, because of my affiliation with the university, I'm able to, I have health insurance. If not, you know, much of my career I was a self-employed writer, and I could go back to being a self-employed writer, and having a healthcare option, I think, is critical. And I think that this is an area where the Republicans have dropped the ball, and have, you know, tried to, you know, just sort of use a lot of sloganeering. But I personally think if the Democrats stay away from identity politics and focus on things like healthcare and income inequality and infrastructure, they'll win. But, you know, the problem is, you know, I'm writing a piece that there's a new committee to reelect the president that's called the Democratic Party.
Well, in the way it's going, I know there's a lot of people that have that thought process right now, and it's because of this, you know, it's either identity politics or maybe policy politics, but in the socialist sort of policies, I don't know what to term them. I don't mean to be derogatory about it, but you know, the freebie for everybody. Oh, that's going to mean I'm going to be better off, and you can certainly understand why people think that. So, what is the injection that needs to be had? If we say tomorrow college is all free, what are some of the injections that need to be had in that discussion as they would pan out over time? Clearly, college can't be free without a payment mechanism. You're still going to have professors, you're still going to have buildings and all that kind of stuff. You can't just turn around and make it free without either the government borrowing a lot of money or some other things. What are some of the things that are going to be attached to these somewhat attractive programs that are being volleyed out there that people are going to have to ultimately wake up and realize that are going to be attached to them?
Well, I think there are going to be some interesting ones. One, of course, is that free for who? I mean, should Warren Buffett's grandchildren have free college? Then free to do what? Do I want to spend my tax dollars on an upper middle class kid who wants to study, postmodernist English? I don't know. I mean, does a society really need people to do that? I would feel a little better if the money was going to teach some kid from Milwaukee to be a machinist or a carpenter. I'm mm-hmm. all in favor of that.
Yep.
So I think and the other thing I think is that it would be seen as a massive transfer of funds from the middle class to the professorial class, to the university administrating class, what I call in the new book, the clerisy. And it would be at an enormous cost to the middle class. Again, living in California has many of its disadvantages and many of advantages, but one of the advantages is I can see what's coming because I see it either being discussed or in some cases implemented. And, what we may end up with is a system in which, the upper middle class is essentially under constant assault by taxes and regulations. And I know there's now ideas that we're going to, put an estate tax on, and starting at not a very high number. When I talk to people, let's say of my age in my mid-60s, they work really hard, and now they own a house, it's worth a lot of money, and the state of California said, well, your house is worth $1 million, well, we're going to take $100,000 for that. Well, people, believe me, the traffic congestion at the airport for the upper middle class leaving is going to be overwhelming. I mean, but we've been seeing this. It's even more extreme, frankly, in places like New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, because they have very very high taxes, and they don't have the weather that we have that may keep people here. So I think that there's a lot of implications for this, and I think people don't understand that all these things, whether it's Medicare for all or free college or a free stipend for everybody whether they want to work or not, it's going to have an enormous cost, and you're going to have to move 50% tax rates from the very wealthy to the moderately wealthy. I mean, it's the only way you can finance this stuff. Mm-hmm. There just isn't enough money, and the Zuckerbergs and the Cooks and the Sergey Brins and the people at the very top of the food chain, they're going to figure out how to protect their wealth.
Sure. I'm not going to be able to figure that out, however.
Right. No, and neither am I. I mean, I make a good living, but I can't afford to pay an accountant $200,000 to hide my money. And so I think that what you're going to see is that I think there will be a reaction. Now, the key thing, I think, is as millennials starting families, trying to buy houses, and start paying taxes, I think they may revise their views of socialism a bit.
Well, we'll have to see. Joel, this has been fascinating, and we'll have to have you back again. Your website is your name, Joel Korkin, KORKIN.com.
KOTKIN.
Oh, I'm sorry, actually. Kotkin. Yeah, KOTKIN. And you got a number of books out that are dealing with these sorts of aspects of the conversation that we've had today, and we encourage people to check you out and check them out, and we'll have to have you back on the show here in a little bit later on.
That sounds great. Thanks.
Right. Joel, thank you for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye.
Pretty interesting stuff. Read into it what you want to. I read into it. The Republicans have a responsibility to fix this before democratic socialism happens.